Before the start of the 1959 season, most pro football experts picked Green Bay to remain in the cellar of the Western Conference. Last and probably least, that's the sad forecast for the once proud Packers. They've got a good new coach in Vince Lombardi, but he might as well kiss this one off as a rebuilding year, declared a prognosticator in Sport magazine. But the team knew it was better than that. Through six preseason games, four of them victories, the players grew more convinced week by week that they could play with anyone in the league. In preparation for the opener against the rival Chicago Bears, Lombardi concentrated on building his new team's sense of family and community. He moved the entire club, including wives and children, to suburban Milwaukee for a final week of training and bonding on the grounds of a private boarding school in Pewaukee. This was a time of year that he came to relish. He'd made the final cuts, the team was set, the playbooks had been studied and learned. Now they could go out to the practice field and drill the same play over and over until it was more than routine and familiar. It was in their blood, part of their reflexive being. This was not just any play, but the play, the power sweep, which came to be known as the Packer sweep. Lombardi had used the sweep in New York and had originally borrowed it from the playbook of the Los Angeles Rams. But once he arrived in Green Bay, he transformed it into something that was singularly identified with him and his Packers. Since his days at West Point, he had based his coaching philosophy on Red Blake's belief that perfection came with simplicity. The theory was to discard the immaterial and refine those few things that one did best. Years later, looking back on his development of the power sweep, Lombardi suggested that every team arrives at a lead play, a number one play, a bread and butter play. It's the play that the team knows it must make go, and the one that opponents know they must stop. Continued success with it, of course, makes a number one play, because from that success stems your own team's confidence. And behind that is the basic truth that it expresses a coach as a coach and the players as a team, and they feel complete satisfaction when they execute it successfully. The sweep was Lombardi's number one play. His offense started with it and revolved around it. In his football lexicon, it was known as the 49. Red right, 49 on two, the quarterback might say. The four signified the formation. Nine was the hole farthest to the right sideline, and two was the snap count. Red right, 49 on two, over and over again. Nothing could make Lombardi happier than the call of that play. He instructed his offensive linemen to take bigger splits, allowing slightly more distance than usual between each of them at the line of scrimmage. Usually they lined up 30 to 36 inches apart. Lombardi wanted them separated by 40 inches. The tight end, the key blocker on the sweep, moved out wider from the right tackle, exactly 9 feet to the tackle's right. Lombardi could sense immediately if it was 8 feet or 10 feet, and it had to be exactly 9 feet. The block of the tight end, Gary Kanafel or Ron Kramer, determined the entire shape of the play. Lombardi instructed the tight end not to leave his feet or smash into his opponent, but rather to calculate in the split second after the snap which direction the left outside linebacker could be pushed. If the linebacker was moving inside, the tight end had to stop him from penetrating the line of scrimmage and bump him toward the middle. If the linebacker was moving outside, the tight end's mission was to get in his way and keep bumping him farther outside, passively allowing the linebacker to beat on him during their contact. The point, said Lombardi, was to block the linebacker. Whichever direction he takes, drive him in that direction. The right tackle, Forrest Gregg, was taught to deliver what was called a slam on the left defensive end. From a three-point stance, Greg drove into the end with his forearm or shoulder, a quick blow intended to set up the defender for a follow-up block, a cut below the knees delivered by the fullback Jimmy Taylor pounding at him from behind the scrimmage line. After slamming the defensive end, the right tackle sought out the middle linebacker and tried to seal him off from the flow of the play. This was what Greg loved to do most, get beyond the line of scrimmage and rumble downfield, setting his radar on a linebacker to eliminate. In time, Lombardi would come to regard his square-jawed right tackle as the greatest downfield blocker he'd ever seen. One of the thrills of the sweep was the glory it provided the men who played offensive guard, Lombardi's old position. On most plays, the guards were hidden in a scrum at the line of scrimmage, the least noticed players on the field, indistinguishable in a tangle of feet, arms, bellies, and sweat-soaked jerseys as they scrapped with the defensive interior linemen. But with the call of the sweep, they were rendered majestic, a powerful and mobile matched set. At the snap of the ball, they swung their right arms back to begin the crossover step that Lombardi had learned from Frank Leahy decades earlier, then traced a precise arc behind the line of scrimmage and out toward the right sideline, ahead of the runner, serving as his proud bodyguards, visible and essential. The right guard, Jerry Kramer, watched which way the tight end pushed the outside linebacker and rumbled toward the opening cleared by that block, inside or out, taking on whoever first appeared in his path. "The first color that isn't ours," as Lombardi put it. The left guard, Fuzzy Thurston, followed behind Kramer from a point deeper in the backfield, with the ball carrier, Paul Hornung, trailing directly behind him. They were so close sometimes that Hornung had his left hand on Thurston's hip. Fuzzy was looking for the next opposing color to come along after Kramer made his block. Thurston and Kramer became the symbols of the Packers' sweep, patrolling the turf ahead of Hornung, circling deep and around the corner, forearms out, ready to strike, numbers 63 and 64 in green and gold. The center, Jim Ringo, had to execute the most difficult block, moving quickly to his right after snapping the ball and hooking the left defensive tackle to prevent him from bolting into the backfield through the hole created when Kramer pulled out to lead the sweep. The left offensive tackle, Bob Skoronski, also pulled right, following Thurston, looking to hit anyone else who penetrated through the line, then turning upfield at the first hole. The flanker, rookie Boyd Dowler, who lined up outside the tight end, had to get inside position on the cornerback covering him and either push him to the outside or level him with a low block. The wide receiver on the other side, Max McGee, ran downfield looking to block the free safety. The play was made to order for Hornung, who lacked burning speed. His teammates teased that he was huffing just to keep up with Fuzzy, but had sharp eyes and powerful legs and a knack of knowing just when to move off Thurston's block and slash upfield. And like Gifford before him, Hornung could transform the sweep into an option pass, a threat that made the defensive backs hesitate for a crucial few seconds. The Packers first learned the sweep in their heads, with Lombardi at the chalkboard, instructing in the same fashion that he taught physics back at St. Cecilia, so that the dimmest pupil could comprehend. The beauty of the sweep, like all of Lombardi's teachings, was that it accommodated seemingly contradictory principles. It was at once simple yet subtle, direct yet flexible. Every player was taught not just what he should do under normal conditions, but how to respond to any unexpected defense. Position by position, Lombardi went through as many as 20 defensive possibilities, offering his players a logical response to each of them. Some coaches, considered innovative, might have 20 plays, but no options for any of them. Lombardi, sometimes mischaracterized as unimaginative, preferred one play with 20 options. It was a variation of the Jesuit concept of freedom within discipline. The sweep, again, symbolized the philosophical lineage from Ignatius of Loyola to Vince Lombardi, both said to be limited to one great idea, but unrestrained in the incomparable realization of it. The sweep had another meaning in Lombardi's system. It was his definition of team, a play in which the offensive players had to think and react together, 11 brains and bodies working as one. Everyone was important in the sweep, said Ron Kramer, recalling in his own lively language the message he took from Lombardi. It's really all of life. We all have to do things together to make this thing we call America great. If we don't, we're fucked. Like Lombardi's charges back at Saints, the Packers took in their lessons with some measure of fear, never knowing when he might order them to the front of the class to diagram a variation of the play. A fine balance between confidence and fear helped make the lessons stick. You're watching this day after day, and it starts sinking in, becoming second nature, Bob Skoronski later explained. And after a while you say, I don't care what happens. We can make this thing go. Then came more repetition on the practice field. In Pewaukee, during the week before the opener against the Bears, it seemed as though the sweep was all they did. The sweep dominated their thoughts and actions, the constant of their lives. Lombardi even injected it into their conditioning drills. For the wind sprints at the end of practice, they didn't line up like most teams, towing a line and chugging downfield in a track race. Instead, Lombardi put them into the sweep formation and had them run out their assignments from that play, all dashing 20 yards to the end zone again and again. The joke on the team was that they ran the sweep until Lombardi got tired. In that week before the Bears game, all the positions on offense seemed set except tight end, where Knafel was fighting to hold on to his job against Ron Kramer, the huge and mobile end from Michigan who had just finished a military commitment but had a knee injury and was struggling to regain his old form. With his competition hobbled, Knafel was at tight end most of the time that week. At the afternoon practice on Thursday, before the team left Pewaukee and headed back to Green Bay, Lombardi put the offense through a final half-hour drill, running sweep after sweep against the starting defensive unit. It was the modern equivalent of Bloody Wednesday for the 7 blocks back on the practice field on Rose Hill. The smell of wet autumn leaves, smack and thud and up for more. Again! Lombardi shouted. Ron Kramer was on the sideline, watching. Knafel was in there for every play, sacrificial lamb, giving himself up to the linebackers, passively bumping them as they pounded him. This was too much like the nutcracker drill for Nitschke. He loved it. Blood spurting out from his knuckles, smeared on his pants, some his, some Knafel's. He and Dan Curry just teeing off. Lombardi screaming, "Move! Knafel! Seal it again!" It seemed as if they had run the play 20 times, and Lombardi was never satisfied. "It's sticky," he would say. "It doesn't look good." Finally, Knafel was so worn out that he lost his fear and said something sarcastic to Lombardi. "Coach," he said, "by this time, I think even Ray knows it's a sweep." Lombardi turned his face to hide a smile. "That's it," he shouted. "Everybody in!" As the players dragged off the field, one of Knafel's young sons came running over to him and shouted, "Daddy, I still love you!" Fine, but what about the seemingly displeased coach? The answer came the next morning, when Knafel was eating breakfast with his wife and kids at the training table, and Lombardi walked up to him and said, in his authoritative voice, softly, but clear enough for the whole family to hear, "You're starting Sunday." 3 simple words. That was all it took to erase the anxiety and fear that Knafel had felt on the practice field when Lombardi was yelling at him. Now, the ordeal seemed worth it. He was floating, 9 feet high. Repetition, confidence, and passion. The Trinity of Lombardi's football success was established that Sunday afternoon, September 27th, when he coached his first regular season professional game. In the locker room beforehand, the players were overtaken by a sensation they hadn't felt in a long time. Something was transforming them. As they put on their Packers uniforms, they seemed surprisingly calm and self-assured. Lombardi worked the room, moving from locker to locker, shaking hands with his men, looking into their eyes, making sure they were ready. Then he gathered them around him for a pregame speech, and his will to win took on a physical manifestation. His body seemed to pulsate as he spoke, his words closing a circle of pride and emotion that began decades earlier, back when sleepy Jim Crowley roused his Fordham Rams by evoking the image of his old mother listening to their game against St. Mary's on the radio as she sat in a rocking chair and counted her rosary beads out in Green Bay, a mythic place in the American heartland that Vinnie Lombardi, right guard among the 7 blocks of granite, had never seen. And now, here he was, in that same faraway place, his coaching dream a reality at last, drawing on his memory of Crowley's ancient exhortation to the team manager to open the door and get out of the way, son. Here comes my Fordham team. Now go through that door and bring back a victory, Lombardi told his Packers. And with those words, Bill Bubba Forrester, a veteran linebacker, jumped up in a frenzied roar and banged his arm on a metal locker, his worst injury of the year, but not enough to stop him from leading his band of brothers, consumed by their mission, on a rampage out of the dressing room and into the darkening gloom and mist of City Stadium. For all his obsession with offense, Lombardi arrived at his head coaching position realizing that he needed a fierce defense to win. He gave his defensive coach, Phil Bengston, more freedom than his other assistants. Bengston ran the defensive meetings and called the alignments during the game. With his phlegmatic demeanor, tall and passive, a camel dangling from his lips, he was a perfect counterpoint to his boss. The players found him a relief from the head coach's relentlessness. But even then, it was Lombardi's defense, in the end, that burned inside his players. And it was the defense that brought Lombardi victory in his professional debut. The offense misplayed 3 easy touchdown opportunities in the first half. But Green Bay's linebackers swarmed over Chicago on the waterlogged field, limiting the Bears to 2 field goals, and the Packers finally put enough points on the board in the final 7 minutes to win 9-6. Jim Taylor busted in for a 5-yard touchdown run, and Hog Hanner, the Razorback giant who'd collapsed on the practice field during the first week of drills, now had enough stamina to tackle Bears quarterback Ed Brown in the end zone for a clinching safety. A play that had been set up by Max McGee's end-over-end 61-yard punt that rolled out of bounds on the Chicago 2. There were 32,150 fans in the stadium that day, unaccustomed in recent years to football success, and they counted down the last 14 seconds as if it was the end of a championship game. When the final gun sounded, Jim Ringo, the center, scooped up the ball and raced to the sidelines. "You deserve this more than anybody else," he said, handing the official Duke pigskin to Lombardi. A phalanx of Packers then swept the coach off his feet, shouting a victory chant as they bore him on their shoulders and trotted off the muddy field up the ramp to the delirium of a winner's locker room. His players had never seen a happier man than Lombardi after that game. He had a grin that wouldn't come off. As he spread praise all around, until he found Max McGee and grabbed him by the cheeks like Grandma Izzo might have done, and kissed him hard on the lips for that game-saving punt. How much did winning mean to this coach? McGee now knew the answer. They all like to win. Every player wants to win. But no one wanted to win as much as that big smackaroo. Chapter 13 Trinity. Yes, strange things happened everywhere, but the Fordham Wall still stands. Here stood the Fordham Wall one more time, aligned at midfield on the gridiron of Roosevelt Stadium in Jersey City, before an exhibition game between Lombardi's Green Bay Packers and the New York Giants. It was the Monday evening of August 22, 1960, almost a quarter century after Grantland Rice wrote Old Gibraltar. The old left tackle, Ed Franco, had organized the reunion, assembling the seven blocks of granite and their coach, Jim Crowley, for the first time since 1937. The blocks were in their late 40s now, and had matured into increasingly irregular shapes, their fame fading with every year that distanced them from their storied accomplishments at Rose Hill, though the poetry and mythology of their nickname saved them from oblivion. Devil Doll Franco operated a 42-lane bowling alley in Secaucus, New Jersey. Leo Paquin was still head football coach at Xavier Prep in Manhattan, where his Chargers had once competed against Lombardi's Little Saints. Tarzan Drews had experienced a coaching rise and fall, working as an assistant for Frank Leahy at Boston College and Notre Dame, before getting his chance as head coach at Marquette University, where he lasted only two losing seasons. He found a job with the Denver-Chicago Trucking Company in central New Jersey. Natty Pierce was in charge of physical rehabilitation at a veterans hospital on Long Island. Alibaba Barbarsky managed a plant for Fruhoff Trailer Company in Dayton. And Alex Wojciechowicz, the mighty Woji, after an illustrious pro career as a linebacker for the Lions and Eagles, returned home to the Jersey Shore to sell real estate. Sleepy Jim Crowley worked the rubber chicken circuit as a wisecracking toastmaster and served on the Pennsylvania Boxing Commission. Lombardi had been the least publicized of Crowley's linemen during their glory days at Fordham, and he got the slowest career start after college. Three of the blocks, Franco, Babartsky, and Wojciechowicz, had played in the NFL, and the other three, Pierce, Drews, and Paquin, had entered the coaching ranks before him. During those early days, there was no certainty that Lombardi would go furthest in football. His apprenticeship had taken 20 years. But now, suddenly, he was a bright new national sports figure, being honored by his reunited friends for his selection as NFL Coach of the Year for his inaugural 1959 season in Green Bay. Lombardi's triumphant return east brought Harry Lombardi down to Jersey City from Englewood, along with Father Tim Moore and his merry band of Carmelite saints. A contingent of New York sports writers crossed the Hudson, marking Lombardi as the coach to watch in a league that was rising along with the new decade. In the locker room after the game, which Green Bay won 16-7, Tarzan Drews, who'd been on the coaching staff at Notre Dame when Hornung played there, was shocked to see the golden boy sitting at his locker nursing a beer and a cigarette. Leahy wouldn't have tolerated drinking and smoking in college, but this was the pros. "Yeah," Hornung said, catching Drews's surprised glance. "It's a little different here." Coach of the Year. That 1959 rookie season in Green Bay had been an erratic one for Lombardi and his men. At first, this matter of winning seemed deceptively easy. The opening day triumph against the Bears was followed by two more home wins over the Detroit Lions and San Francisco 49ers, and by the middle of October, the Packers were lodged in first place in the Western Conference. The turnaround coach was bathed in sporting press platitudes. Tom Miller, the team publicist, declared that Lombardi could have his choice of being mayor of Green Bay or governor of Wisconsin. Headlines pronounced Lombardi a miracle man. One New York newspaperman noted that not since Napoleon's escape from Elba has such spirit been generated as the aroused hopes of Green Bay citizens over the comeback of their team. Tex Maugham in Sports Illustrated found Lombardi's quick success as further proof of his theme that the modern professional game was becoming a sophisticated science. He wrote a column praising Lombardi's cold, analytical mind and repeating the lore that the coach had a law degree. The players themselves, when asked to account for their transformation, to a man attributed their success to Lombardi. Linebacker Tom Bettis admitted that he had shed 25 pounds in training camp and gained needed quickness because of Lombardi's conditioning program. Hog Hanna, also in the best shape of his life, said the players were motivated by the fear that if you goof off, somebody else will take your job. Gary Kniffel acknowledged that fear was a motivating factor, but said it made him play better. We should have had Lombardi 5 years ago, he exclaimed. Lamar McCann, the rejuvenated quarterback, called Lombardi a force, who radiated his ability and desire down to his men. He knows what he's talking about, McCann added, is very precise about it, and a lot of his orders work out. Lombardi, for his part, wasn't shy about accepting credit, telling one reporter, you defeat defeatism with confidence, and confidence comes from the man who leads. You just have it. It's not something you get. You have to have it right here in your belly. A test of that confidence came soon enough, along with a reminder that any coach, even one as effective as Lombardi, is not everything in football. That players also matter. By the time the Packers played their fourth game of the 1959 season against the Los Angeles Rams, they'd lost their roughneck fullback Jim Taylor, who had only just begun to show his great promise. A freak injury put him out of the lineup for several games. He'd been lounging in the living room of his Green Bay apartment one weekday evening when his wife called out that a fire had started in the kitchen. She'd been frying potatoes when the cooking grease burst into flames. Taylor dashed in, grabbed the frying pan, and was trying to keep it balanced while carrying it outside, but spilled the hot grease, severely burning his right hand and bare feet. Three other starters were injured as well, in more traditional football ways, and the Packers were outmatched by the Rams, losing 45-6. It was the start of a five-game losing streak, the longest of Lombardi's career. There were a few moments of personal despair. Bart Starr became so despondent over his lack of playing time at quarterback behind McCann that he was spotted drinking several beers with Ron Kramer after a game in New York, a sighting as rare as a giraffe striding down Fifth Avenue. Bart had four beers. Miller High Lifes. It was the last time anyone saw him like that, Kramer later reported. But for the most part, the Packers maintained their confidence during the mid-season losing streak. They felt like winners even as they were losing. So thoroughly had Lombardi rid them of the defeatism that had permeated the squad under Scooter McClain. Losing can have vastly disparate effects on athletes. Some teams learn nothing from a loss, but fall deeper into the abyss. The plays seem predictable. The squad grows selfish. Lombardi's team reacted in the opposite way. The players learned more about themselves with each loss. Not only that they hated losing, but that they were close to winning, and that, as McCann had said earlier, most of what Lombardi was teaching them actually worked, and eventually would allow them to prevail. They learned something else equally important about their coach. As much as he ridiculed the notion of a good loser, he was not short-sighted in pursuit of victory. The truth was that he seemed more ornery after a game in which they'd played poorly and won than after a loss in which they'd played hard. After 5 weeks of being battered and beaten, the Packers closed the season with 4 straight wins, finishing with a record of 7-5, good enough for 3rd place in the West. The first Green Bay team in a dozen years to have more wins than losses. The offense began clicking during the winning streak. After McCann left the lineup with an injury and Joe Francis was tried briefly, Lombardi finally called on Starr. The 4th-year man from Alabama still seemed tentative and prone to throwing interceptions, but he improved week by week. And by the final 2 games on the West Coast against the Rams and 49ers, which the Packers won convincingly, 38-20 and 36-14, he seemed to be operating the most explosive offense in the league. Taylor had returned to bang through the middle. Hornung had perfected the option sweep, throwing 2 touchdown passes in the final game. And Starr had begun to learn how to become Lombardi's quarterback, which is to say, he was starting to think exactly like the coach. It was during the San Francisco game that Starr had a quarterback's epiphany. He was poised at the line of scrimmage, bent over center waiting for the snap, and as he looked across the line, he read the defense in a nanosecond and changed the play accordingly. What had once seemed rushed and confusing now seemed clear and obvious, as though it were all happening in slow motion. One quick look, and everything that Lombardi had taught him snapped into order. Read and react. Freedom within discipline. It was also during the 49ers game that Starr began to assert himself with his teammates, at one point insisting that garrulous Mac McGee hush up in the huddle. The order had a delayed effect. It seemed so out of character that Jim Ringo called a timeout so the offensive lineman could stop laughing. But from then on, Starr commanded his team's respect. Soon after the season ended, Lombardi appeared on Frank Gifford's It's Sports Time radio show in New York and was introduced by his former player as having overseen the best reclamation project since the raising of the Normandy. The Packers might not yet be the best club in the league, Lombardi told Gifford, but in one quality there are few like it. We have great determination, and in Bart Starr, we're going to have one of the great quarterbacks in football. In fact, Frank, with what we've already shown, it makes me want to look forward to next season. Later that week, while he was still on the East Coast, visiting with Harry and Matty and the rest of the Lombardi family, he was named NFL Coach of the Year in an Associated Press poll of sports writers and sportscasters. Vinny Vidi Vici, NFL's top coach, read the headline in one New York paper. He won 29 of 37 first-place votes, with 4 going to Jim Lee Howell of the Giants and 2 to Weeb Eubank of the Colts, whose teams were meeting for the 2nd straight year in the championship game. I was hoping to win 5 games tops, he told the press that day. 7 was a surprise. Determination made the difference. I know it sounds corny, but that's the way it was. When he got back to Green Bay, Ruth McCloskey, his secretary, noticed a certain bounce in his step as he strutted around the office, smiling broadly when someone mentioned the honor. Then Marie dropped by and decided that he seemed a little too proud of himself. "You may be Coach of the Year to everybody else," she said, "but you're still just Vince Lombardi to me." There were times when he responded to his wife's irritations by yelling at her, even in public. "Shut up, Marie," was one of his familiar refrains. This time he turned silent until she left. Boy, he didn't like that, because she said it in front of us, McCloskey later recounted. He didn't say anything, but he got in his office, and you could just tell. 1960, the dawn of a new decade, a time to move up and out, and the Lombardis followed the crowd from city to suburb, from old house to new, heading farther south in Alloway past the massive stone state reformatory, out to a custom-built ranch house on Sunset Circle, constructed to display the middle-class modern tastes that Marie shared with her husband. It was one level, long and low, with a narrow front portico, red brick with two front picture windows trimmed in white, wide driveway leading to side garage, sleek, elegant French furniture, custom drapes from H.C. Prangies hung twice before Marie approved, built-in grill next to the kitchen stove, open counter leading from kitchen to the eating room, wall-to-wall carpeting, den and TV room around the back L with wood paneling and console television in front of two big chairs, one the old man's recliner, a bedroom nearby, two more down the far hall, another guest bedroom in the basement behind the house-long rectangular party room and bar for entertaining friends after games. Three fireplaces went unused. Lombardi was afraid of fire, haunted by a childhood mishap in which he burned his arm. The setting seemed exotic then, so open and modern in contrast to the old streets of the east side that intersected Riverside on the way downtown. Slightly humped in the middle and sloping to the curbs, darkened by overhanging oaks and elms, two-story wood-frame houses huddling close together block after block of the same rectangular grid. Sunset Circle broke into daylight. A daring half-loop of quarter-acre lots, with undeveloped land separating the four families inside the semicircle. Between the Lombardis and Riverside Drive stood vacant land that later served as an informal parking lot for Packers fans who drove out after Sunday victories to gaze at the coach's shrine. To the west, and across the loop, was a field of river brush and wild asparagus, that grew down to the railroad bed running alongside the nearby Fox River. All this within easy commute of Lombardi's three primary workplaces. 3.8 miles up Riverside Drive and Monroe Street, then left at Crooks to reach the downtown Packer offices. About 6 miles up and across the river to City Stadium, and only 1.6 miles south to the training camp at St. Norbert in West De Pere. He could reach any of them within 15 minutes. It wasn't just the unused fireplaces that made the new Lombardi house feel cold. Inside, it seemed uncomfortably silent and somber much of the week. The halls were dark and uninviting. A friend of Susan said that her lasting image of the home was one of sadness. It was a sad house as soon as you walked in. Empty. You could feel the family void. The defining scene was at the dinner table. Vincent on one side, quiet and tense. Susan on the other, chatting away, oblivious, until she realized that no one was responding to her. Marie perched at the end nearest the kitchen, impeccably dressed, bony and uneasy, offering little visible motherly comfort to her children, barely showing interest in the events of their days, instead focusing her gaze on her husband across the way, looking at him with awe and adoration as he sat there, eyes on his plate, chewing his meat, thinking about who knows what, stars sore ribs, the Bears linebackers, the Rams passing game, a new wrinkle in the belly series. When he cleared his throat, the others stiffened with anticipation. Maybe at last the father would speak, his voice deep and resounding. "Pass the salt, Marie." Little Ricky was gone by then. The dachshund scrambled for daylight whenever the front door opened, even on the bleakest of northern Wisconsin days, and one morning he made a vain effort to flee across the street and was struck by a snowplow. Marie took him to the vet and had him put to sleep, then broke the news to Susan and Vincent, a more difficult task than the time back in New Jersey when she had to tell them that she had gassed their pet duck. The house would become even emptier with Vincent leaving, bound for college at St. Thomas, a small private school in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he could play football with minimum pressure. Vincent had matured during his year and a half at Green Bay Promontory, but his teenage life as the namesake of Vince Lombardi was still stressful. His father, preoccupied with coaching duties, didn't find time to watch any of his football games, a paternal absence that was in dramatic contrast to the devotion with which old Harry had followed Vince's playing career at St. Francis and Fordham. Vince was Harry's life in a way that Vince could not repeat for Vincent. He did attend one meeting of the Parents Club, but Father Tom DeWayne, then a teacher at Promontory, recalled that he appeared bored to death and never came back. Vincent always felt the old man's stern judgment looming over him, even when his father was not there physically. The conflict between father and son worried Marie, who tried to ease the tension. She attended Vincent's games and cheered him on, believing that he could be a superior athlete, but because of this thing with his father, he was too tense. Vincent's grades improved considerably at Promontory, but one time he received a deficiency slip, which was sent home to Lombardi, who resorted to his favorite disciplinary measure by grounding the son. Marie felt that Vincent was isolated enough in Wisconsin and didn't deserve such harsh punishment. She called the Promontory principal and pleaded, "If my son ever gets in trouble again, please don't send it to Vince, send it to me." Even when Vincent tried to emulate his father, it seemed to backfire. In his senior year at Promontory, he revealed to his dad that his ambition was to become a coach. Football was Vincent's world, like his father's. He couldn't imagine anything else. Yet when he announced that he intended to major in physical education in preparation for a coaching career, Lombardi reacted coldly, saying, "That's fine with me, but if you do, I'll not put one penny towards your education." It turned out that Lombardi wanted his son to be a lawyer, the same ambition his parents once had for him. In the summer before college, Vincent worked at a pickle factory, a job his father had arranged. His function on the assembly line was to take jars of pickles off a conveyor belt and load them into crates. If this was meant to toughen Vincent, he reacted the same way Lombardi had back when he was forced to haul huge slabs of frozen meat at Harry's wholesale butcher shop. He hated it. The one image Vincent carried with him decades later was of a bored worker pissing into the vat of pickle brine. It was a relief for him to quit that job and serve as a ball boy at training camp in late July, and even more of a relief to flee Green Bay for a new life at college. One person unmoved by Vincent's departure was his younger sister. Susan and Vincent, separated by 5 years, were also distant emotionally and intellectually. They scrapped constantly. When their parents were out and Vincent was forced to babysit, he sent Susan to her room and imprisoned her there, chasing her back if she tried to escape. Seeking revenge once, she and Mary Jo Antle slipped into his room before he'd returned from football practice and placed thumbtacks under the bedsheet. After plopping down on the bed and yelping in pain, he chased her out the back door with a baseball bat. Their differences were so evident that later in life, Susan asked her brother in puzzlement, "How could you and I get raised in the same family?" Vincent was anxious, earnest, intelligent, with an outward appearance of arrogance that hid his inner struggle to understand himself and to overcome the guilt he felt for failing to live up to his father's image. Susan was carefree, loud, open, friendly, never a good student, struggling to hold down her weight, more frustrating to her parents than to herself. She was disarmingly candid about her shortcomings and her difficult position as the daughter of the coach in a town where football was everything. "I know the truth," she would declare forthrightly. "I know they only like me because I'm Lombardi's daughter." Yet she thirsted for affection and would take it any way she could get it. Her favorite place was not at home nor at school, but at the stables at Oneida Golf and Riding, where her horse, Captain Gladys, greeted her with unconditional love. Marie at times seemed harsh in dealing with Susan's appearance. At social gatherings at Sunset Circle, Susan often served hors d'oeuvres to the guests. One evening, as she moved around the room with a tray, her mother blurted out, loud enough for all to hear, "God, I wish that girl could lose weight!" The grief Susan took from her father was louder but less personal. "What you saw on the field, where he'd be yelling and screaming, he came home and did that. We never questioned it," Susan remembered. "My father was a great one for screaming and yelling at you, then turning around and saying, 'I'm sorry.'" When he yelled at Susan, it was usually over some trivial matter, such as his socks. He maintained a precise order in his sock drawer. Black, blue, brown, white. And took inventory every day or so, largely because he was colorblind, and didn't want to be embarrassed wearing an inappropriate color with his shoes and slacks. Susan often slipped into his room and filched a pair of white socks, but rarely got away with it. He knew how many pairs he had, and he'd come out screaming and yelling until I coughed up the socks. It could be pretty explosive. For the most part, though, Susan's relationship with her father was less tense than Vincent's. When Lombardi found time for her, he showed uncharacteristic patience. She long remembered the few times he brought her into the living room, where they sat together reverently listening to Madame Butterfly on a reel-to-reel tape, with her father narrating the story. "This is when she's going to try to kill herself." Unlike his brother Harold, who was then working for an insurance company in San Francisco, Vince was unsophisticated in the arts, but he enjoyed opera, along with the popular music of Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Dean Martin, and Bobby Darin. "He thought he could sing," Susan later said of him, sarcastically. "He'd walk around the house trying to sing Mac the Knife. He was also entranced by modern contraptions. Once he'd appeared at the front door of the Antles house holding a battery-operated portable record player under his arm. 'Listen to this,' he said, when Mary Jo Antle answered the door, and he pushed a button and beamed as though he were witnessing a miracle as the tinny sound of his favorite song crackled out. 'And when that shark bites with his teeth, babe.'" This autocrat of the football world found pleasure in unexpected diversions and habits. His favorite method of easing tension at home was cleaning closets. He also enjoyed reading mathematics books and was an ardent collector of cookbooks, accumulating scores of them, even though Marie preferred to eat out and his own culinary skills stopped at char-grilled steaks and wet scrambled eggs. It was an escape into fantasy for him. He would read a cookbook with the same narrative delight that he had long ago taken in the adventure tales of Richard Halliburton, not skipping around from the table of contents to favorite selections, but moving page by page from front cover to back, engrossed in the plot line from tomatoes Provençal to Italian Parmesan and egg soup to braised rack of lamb to marzipan cake. "You know what? We really ought to make this," he declared now and then, but they never would. Another of his fantasies was that he was a magician. He took childlike delight in magic tricks and practiced a few of the simplest ones involving strings, balls, and handkerchiefs over and over, though never nearing mastery.
"Mr. Lombardi, you blew it!"
a neighborhood boy screamed one day when Lombardi tried to perform a trick, making a cigarette move on the table while rubbing the youngster's head. Everyone in town seemed to know the coach, but Lombardi's inner circle of Green Bay friends was relatively small. It included Canadeo and Borgannon from the Packers' board of directors, and several cronies from the foursomes at Oneida Golf and Riding, among them Jack Kepler, an insurance man who underwrote the Packers' team policies, Ray Antle, Mary Antle's husband, a salesman who specialized in a line of Packers' memorabilia, Jack Stathis, the auto dealer who provided Lombardi with his choice of Pontiac, Bonnevilles, and Catalinas every 6 months from Brown County Motors. And Harry Mass, who owned a local printing company. Father Dennis Burke, president of St. Norbert, and various other priests and doctors who were allowed into his coveted inner circle, along with old friends and sports writers visiting from the East. The Green Bay Press was decidedly not part of the group, nor were his assistant coaches or other members of the Packers' front office. He socialized only on weekends during the season and followed a familiar routine. Friday night began with cocktails at Dick and Lois Borgannon's. Then down to the strip on Washington Street in a caravan of cars and inside Wally Prosky's Food and Cocktail Lounge for the Green Bay Catholic ritual of Fish Fry Friday. The proprietor greeting Vince at the door, all smiles and pats on the back, the other regular patrons looking up, seeing the coach, murmuring, but allowing him his privacy. The party ushered into a back room, plates of fish and fries and slaw and pitchers of beer, then out into the dark northern night for the ride back to Alloway. Saturday found Vince relaxed, surprisingly at ease just at the time when most coaches would be unapproachable, which he seemed to be almost any time except then. With preparations complete, the game plan set, for a few hours at least, Mr. Hilow was demonstrably high, free and easy with his pals on the golf course in early autumn, playing gin in the clubhouse, treating himself and Marie to 16-ounce porterhouse steaks at the elegant Stratosphere Club out on County Trunk Inn. There was more socializing on Sunday after the game. Friends, priests, visiting journalists thawing out, chatting, drinking whiskey and Budweiser and hams in the wood-paneled basement rec room on Sunset Circle, smoke curling toward the low ceiling. Jake Stathis, as bartender, pouring Lombardi's liquor into glass tumblers, bourbon for himself, scotch for the coach. Father Burke of St. Norbert, munching away on the chips and Marie's hot crab meat dip, cream cheese, crab meat, mayo, mustard, and a touch of wine fresh from the oven. Lombardi, leaning on the bar, sipping his drink, a Salem burning away in the groove of his big glass ashtray, taking calls and greeting guests. You could tell how the game went without going to City Stadium. If Lombardi was booming, laughing, illuminating the room with his teeth, the pack had played well, no doubt. Then off to another restaurant, alternately the Zyder Zee or Mancy's Supper Club. Lombardi seated next to a priest, growing quieter by the minute until finally Marie would look over and realize that he was gone, lost to the world, drained from the last game, anxious about the next one. This was his worst time, Sunday night around 8 o'clock, when, as he once described it, that deep, dull, indescribable weariness began extracting the cork, or so it seemed, from my whole being. The only way he could overtake the weariness was by thinking about the next game. Marie could see precisely what was happening and thought to herself, she said later, "Oh boy, he's coaching again. The curtains come down." The change was so dramatic and predictable that she took to calling him Cinderella. Marie fell into a depression after her son left for college, a mood for which her drinking was alternately cause and effect. She seemed to disappear occasionally during parties at her home. Only her family knew that she had passed out in bed. She had conflicted feelings about her situation in Green Bay. She told friends that she felt it was her role to control her husband's pride and temper and to serve as a buffer between Vin and his players and the community. Yet the fact that he was becoming an esteemed public figure made her feel more worthy. Some in Green Bay saw this response as an expression of regal arrogance, and they found it off-putting, particularly in combination with her sharp Jersey accent, her loud voice, direct manner, tailored clothes, and preference for long fur coats and jewelry. There were whispers around town about Marie's aloofness, an Easterner who could not fit in. She in turn expressed puzzlement at what she considered the too cozy behavior of the locals. In Green Bay, they would say, "There's a new painting at the museum, and collect 40 people to go see it," she once explained. "I'd rather go by myself." But she was not a recluse. She formed close friendships with a few women, including Lois Borgannon, and became a presence in Green Bay social circles, participating in the Christian Mothers Society, the Antiquarian Society, and the Republican Club, making dazzling ornaments, beaded flowers, and crocheted tablecloths for church bazaars, instructing the younger wives of Lombardi's assistants in the ways of being a coach's wife. That last was the mission she took most seriously, bringing to it more devotion than she demonstrated as a mother. She became expert in the art of explaining her husband, which days he would be distant and distracted, which days she could talk to him. She studied the players, assessing which ones had talent, quietly soothing the feelings of those who had encountered Lombardi's wrath. "Can you get him off my back?" a player would ask her, to which she would reply, "How would you like to live with him?" The exchange was at once lighthearted and truthful. The players unavoidably caught a few uncomfortable glimpses of the tension within the Lombardi marriage. As much as Marie tried to adjust to her husband's life, sometimes it was not enough. At the training table one evening, Marie had ordered a special ice cream dessert for herself when the team was being served pie, and when Vince noticed it, he banged his fist on the table and shouted, "God damn it, Marie! When you're with the team, you eat what the team eats!" Yet no one could better interpret Lombardi's psyche than Marie. Many Packers came to accept his punishing style, or at least endure it. After Marie let them in on the secret she had learned after 20 years at his side, "If Lombardi was on your case, that meant he saw something in you. There was more reason to be concerned if he didn't yell at you. That usually meant you were a goner." Willie Wood seemed to be an exception to that rule. As a 23-year-old rookie in 1960, he sprinted through training camp without encountering any disparaging words from the coach, or many words at all. After the first 2 weeks, Lombardi walked past him on the way off the practice field and muttered, "Keep up the good work, Willie." Later, before the exhibition game in Jersey City, honoring the 7 blocks, the coach warned Wood that he should play through the pain of a strained ankle. "If you want to make this team, you can't make it being injured," Lombardi said tersely in the locker room, walking away before his young player could respond. "Well, I better get well," Wood thought to himself, according to his later account. "The first thing I can't do with this man is complain about injuries." That William Vernelli Wood was challenging for a place on the Packers at all was a measure of his mental strength and perseverance. It also underscored the determination of Lombardi and his personnel man, Jack Vanisi, to ignore the prejudices then prevalent in most NFL front offices in their search for the most talented players. Not that Wood came out of nowhere. For most of his junior year and all of his senior year, he'd been the starting quarterback at the University of Southern California, one of the nation's leading programs. Yet NFL scouts left him off their lists of prospects, partly on the advice of his college coaches, who claimed that he lacked the skills to make it at the next level. When the rookie draft was held before the 1960 season, 240 players were chosen, 5 from USC. But Wood was not among them. He was neglected, considered a man without a position, said to lack the arm of a quarterback or the speed of a running back. Left unstated, but influencing his situation as much as anything, was the fact that Wood was a black quarterback in an era when black athletes were seldom allowed the opportunity to play that position. Their numbers were slim in college and virtually non-existent in the pros. The Packers were among the few teams that had ever carried a black quarterback on their roster. Charlie Brackens from Prairie View A&M had been drafted in the 17th round in 1955 and made the roster briefly. He suited up for 7 games and played once, but completed no passes and then was cut. Wood looked raw failure in the face and refused to accept it. After being shunned on draft day, he retreated to the cramped one-room studio apartment that he shared with his wife on the USC campus and typed a letter introducing himself, detailing his college record and stating that he could contribute to some team if only given the chance. Where should he send the letter? He'd already made one painful but crucial decision, offering his services as a defensive back rather than quarterback. He studied the rosters of all 13 NFL teams. The odd 13th club, added that year, was the Dallas Cowboys, originally named the Dallas Rangers, analyzing which ones might need a ball-hawking safety. Wood had grown up in Washington, D.C., in the shadows of Union Station, and was a star athlete at Armstrong High near the corner of 1st and O Streets, Northwest, from where a young USC assistant named Al Davis had recruited him to junior college and then to USC. But he never considered playing for the Washington Redskins, even though they were woefully in need of defensive talent. His hometown was still segregated, the most southern city in the league, and its owner, George Preston Marshall, was an unreconstructed racist who didn't want black players on his team. Wood decided to send his letter to the Giants and 49ers, which had well-established traditions of hiring black players, and to the Packers. He didn't know Lombardi from Adam, he said later, but he'd heard that Green Bay had a new front office and surmised that they might be interested in him. The Packers were in fact the only team to respond. First came a positive letter from Lombardi, followed shortly by a visit from Vanisi. At first glance, Wood was not the most impressive recruit. He stood just under 5'10", weighed less than 175 pounds, and his sprint times were average. But he had broad shoulders and a thick neck, along with some unteachable traits. He was fearless, quick, and agile, able to touch the top of the goalpost crossbar with his elbow from a standing leap. Vanisi offered him a $6,500 contract and sealed the agreement with a handshake. Wood was the last man to make the 1960 squad, and he was overwhelmed after it became clear that he had survived. When the Packers traded his rookie competitor for the final slot to the Dallas expansion team, he called his old high school coach, Ted McIntyre, who'd also lobbied the Packers to sign Wood, and shouted into the phone, "Hey, I made it, coach, I made it!" Thinking back on what he'd endured, he realized it had been worth the pain and effort. It was such a long shot, I was so pleased with myself. That lasted until the following Monday morning, when Wood attended his first meeting of the regular season squad. There stood Lombardi in the front of the room, glaring directly at the rookie, or so it seemed, and declaring that nobody really made his team until the second year, and even then they shouldn't feel too comfortable. "It was almost as though he was reading my mind," Wood said later. "He must have known that I might think the pressure was off, and it's never off. It was as though he was saying directly to me, 'You have to knock yourself out here every day.'" Playing football, knocking himself out, was not the most trying task for Willie Wood during his rookie season with the Packers. He felt more pressure simply enduring the routines of daily life. He felt the blast heat of prejudice the first time he stepped off the bus as a Green Bay Packer before his first exhibition game, played against the Pittsburgh Steelers in New Orleans, a neutral site for everyone but the black athletes. The scene remained vivid in Wood's memory. The team bus whines to a halt in front of a downtown hotel. Lombardi and the coaches march off. Players clamber down in